I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Anthony Bateman, who's already been referred to several times. I'm not going to read through the bios. You have the complete bios in your programs. I encourage you to take a look at that. Dr. Bateman's accomplishments are tremendous. I will mention that he provides instruction, supervision, consultation to many agencies in England and the United States. I actually don't understand how he can be in so many places at the same time. But that includes, local to our region, the Gunderson House, and you can see McLean's display out front, that he oversees, provides supervision for the mentalization that they provide there. He's obviously the developer of mentalization-based therapy for borderline personality disorder, along with Peter Fonagy, with its demonstrated effectiveness. And if you are here, please. Dr. Anthony Bateman.
Have you turned it on?
No, I didn't turn anything off.
No, I meant the...
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Seth. Thank you very much for organizing, inviting me. I'm not in all sorts of places all of the time. Sometimes I'm at home, and I can be contacted there occasionally. Thank you, Perry Hoffman, Alan Frazetti, Jim Dale, I can't see, but others, and for the MBT experts and DBT experts for coming to this conference. Alan Frazetti, I'm not going to thank you, giving us more work to do, really. Anyway, thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me. I'm going to give a sort of overview of mentalization-based treatment as best I can in a short period of time, and I hope to give you a sort of flavor of the therapy itself and the underlying theory. If you need further information, most of the slides are on a website at the university, at University College in London, so that address is in your slides. If I'm allowed to do a bit of advertising for Europe, but we are organizing a conference in Amsterdam in 2012. For those of you who are interested, this is the second conference, International Congress on Borderline Personality Disorder. A successful one was held in Berlin last summer, and this will be the second conference following on from that. Do come. Amsterdam's a fantastic place, I can tell you. It has absolutely everything. Okay. So on to mentalizing and this idea. Its popularity has rather astonished us and slightly outstrips, I suspect, its sort of power, really, in some ways. But just to say why I think that it may have a certain sort of popularity and gets picked up by a rather disparate group of people with many different interests is really this, that I think it probably can be taken up into all sorts of different frameworks. And so it has a sort of integrative aspect to it, so that people can relate to it, whatever your particular sort of line is, whether it's from philosophy to neuropsychiatry to neurology to dialectics and so on. You can tend to relate to mentalizing, oddly enough, which we never occurred to us 15, 20 years ago. But certainly the cognitive behavioral sort of aspects to therapies and to ideas about relating thoughts to feelings and so on, and those processes, they pick up mentalizing and run with it in various directions. And certainly the systems people, the systemic ideas, have taken up mentalizing and incorporated to some extent in their treatments and in their ideas. We originated from a sort of psychodynamic stable, so we're a relatively modified system from psychodynamics. So psychodynamic understanding likes mentalizing for certain aspects of how we use the term and how we use it. And, of course, in sort of social ecological systems. So mentalizing has been used as an idea in interventions in schools, for example, and in other community settings. So there's a kind of extensive use of the idea in different ways. So it seems to appeal to a wide range of people, and I think that it's mostly because it will sort of integrate. Okay. So there is within it then a sort of, it becomes a slightly common language, and people translate it into their own languages quite easily. So you'll begin to do that as I talk. You'll say, oh, well, that's really this, that's really that, and so on. And that's fine. You can do that. Just translate it. I'm quite happy for French to go to English to go to Russian. The problem is it gets a little bit distorted by the time it's gone to Chinese or something. But nevertheless, do translate it. It is translatable in some ways. So what is mentalizing? Well, at its baseline, at its bottom line, it is in fact sort of interpreting both implicitly, i.e. beneath the level of conscious awareness, and much more explicitly, i.e. deliberately so and so on, interpreting the actions of oneself and others as meaningful on the basis of an intentional mental state. So we understand behaviours and actions according to our understanding of our own mental states and others' mental states. So we have continually appraising what's going on in minds of us others, as well as working out what's going on in our own mind. And, of course, this can be extremely difficult sometimes, and at other times, of course, goes along perfectly smoothly and perfectly well. But in order to be able to do some mentalizing, we clearly have to be able to understand our own, or let's say someone else's, underlying desires for that moment, for that time, or their current need, or their underlying feeling for this, or even their belief systems and so on. The better understanding we have of those things, the more likely we are to accurately understand someone's intention. So that's fundamentally what the process of mentalizing is. And I'm going to break it down a little bit, because for clinical practice, we need to break it down and have some fundamentals. But some people have come up with ideas about what mentalizing is and to remember what it is. So when you're sitting with a patient or you're sitting with a friend even or something like that, you may sometimes have to start trying to work things out a little more carefully. And people have come up with ideas, you know, having mind in mind, that's what it's about. All right, not being so influenced by the behavior in some form, but actually influenced by what might be going on in that person's mental processes at that moment. All right, so that's one thing. I prefer sort of understanding misunderstanding, because when somebody misunderstands, we tend to correct them in a sort of reciprocal way. So if they look a bit puzzled, well, we'll come back to that, you may say, are you puzzled about that? Well, it's sort of this. And you try and explain it a little bit more, and they go, oh, you know, and they demonstrate that they've understood something a little better. This is the mentalizing process, or a component of it, in action. So things like that. One of them that somebody came up with was actually really what mentalizing is to be able to see ourselves actually from the outside and others from the inside. So we can see how someone sees us as they say they see us, and actually we see them from the inside, and this sort of thing. When I said that to my daughter when she was much younger, when I was trying to explain some of this, for goodness sake, I had no idea why I was trying to explain it, but I think I was probably asked. And she said, she looked at me and she looked, I said, do you get the idea? She said, that'd drive you mad. I said, really? What, you mean trying to work out how you're seen from the outside? She says, yes, if I worried about that all the time, I'd be paranoid. And I said, well, that's not quite what I mean, you know. And I thought, well, maybe it's best not to go further with this. I said, all right, you don't worry about it. So you can see how these things can shift off. But it is, the idea is there, that when somebody sees you in a certain way, you have to work out how come they're seeing you like that and so on. And when you see their inside in some way, you have to work out how come they're experiencing that now. So these are some of the aspects of mentalizing. And Lois Choi Kahn, who's here, and you'll see later, and those of you who saw her yesterday, and John Gunderson wrote a summary paper about what mentalizing is, because it can be a little bit of a smoky concept. We have tried to firm it up a bit since then, but they wrote a good article in the American Journal of Psychiatry where they actually outline the differences and similarities, the overlaps between other concepts that link to mentalizing. Now, I'm not going into this. Some people feel it's all a bit obsessional and probably doesn't really matter. But in fact, mindfulness is different from some of the other, mentalizing is different from some of the other processes, such as mindfulness in certain ways. And you can read about that. We wrote about it in Mentalizing in Clinical Practice, and there's a whole section on differences and overlaps and so on, for those of you who are obsessional enough to be interested in that. I actually think it is quite important, but other people think not. I say that because the review of that book, the reviewer had obviously read the book very carefully, which is a little bit unusual, and they wrote back, and in the comments in each chapter, it came to this chapter, and it said, is this chapter really necessary? It seems particularly obsessional and pernickety. Let's hold off there. So anyway, we kept the chapter. We didn't. But it's very important in some ways that you see these elements. And I'm just going to, therefore, expand these elements for you now for clinical practice, because the focus in clinical practice is on the mentalizing process. Okay. And what we're seeing here is actually, if you break down this process, that fundamentally in clinical practice, let's just take it an individual session. So you have one therapist, you have a patient. What you therefore have, in a way, is the therapist who's trying to monitor their own mental processes, that self, whilst at the same time representing in their own mind the patient's mental processes and balancing, comparing those in some way. At the same time, you're asking your patient to do that, to monitor their own, pay attention to their own mental processes, whilst at the same time trying to see what the hell's my therapist talking about? Why did they say that? You know, is my therapist crazy or what? You know, what are they not listening? You know, but to try to work out why my therapist is saying that. So you've got these sort of four components in it, right? So you've got the sort of self and other component. But a lot of what's going on in the session, of course, will be implicit. You'll be moving around with your patient moves around with you, implicitly picking up what's going on and what you're saying in various ways. So a lot of it is automatic. But some of it will, of course, become explicit and much more controlled. You as a therapist will try and control it. You will slow the session down. You'll say, hang on, I don't understand that. How does that relate to that? Sorry, I don't, you know, and you will slow it down. You'll be explicit about trying to understand those underlying processes. And you hope your patient will do exactly the same. That's what you want them to be doing. If they don't understand, instead of saying, oh, God, you're useless or something, you actually want them to say, actually, what do you mean by that? Or something like that. You want to get them to be explicit in ways that actually further the understanding of what's going on. So, and you equally will not say to your patient, what are you talking about, for goodness sake? You know, this is not going to generate a sort of interactive, positive, constructive process. So a lot of it becomes explicit. The thing you have to watch out for, though, are the implicit automatic assumptions. We all do this. We make assumptions about what someone's saying or what they're doing or what it means. Typical example in therapies, somebody says how they feel, they say, I feel hurt. Right? You immediately fill in from your own perspective what hurt is. Because you have a sense of hurt, you represent it, and so on. You assume that your hurt's the same as their hurt. This is an assumption, because someone else's hurt may be very different from your hurt, i.e. their representation of it, their experience of it. It may be more acute, it may be more extensive, it may have a different content in it, and so on. It has a very different perspective. So in mentalizing, you will always say, tell me a little bit more about that. What is this hurt? You see what I mean? You get them to expand their sense of what they're saying, the experience is. A third pole of this sort of mentalizing process is very often how we actually try to understand mental states. We use external cues. We use external foci, they're called an external focus. We look at facial expressions. We look at actually eye movements. We look at how body shifts and so on. And we judge from that. We actually make assumptions from it. These are very dangerous, generally. They're often right. But usually in therapy, you're going to try to go beyond that and go to internal. Right, so we all do external. Typical example would be the patient of mine, and she's still seeing me in treatment, and actually she did do it the other week. Was one time she was talking about something and suddenly said to me, she said, you don't believe me, do you? I said, because I was being quite on my own model, as it were, said, what on earth made you say that? I'm sorry, where did that come from? You know, I had no idea where that came from. And she said, "You just don't believe me, do you?" I said, "Well, actually, I wasn't aware that actually I was feeling sort of sense of disbelief." I said, "I'm not aware of that." I said, "What made you suddenly say it?" And she said, "Oh, you crossed your arms." Right? Now, this is an external focus with an assumption of what's internal. Okay? So now, occasionally, I still cross my arms. I then, for about a month, was completely frozen, and I didn't dare move. But after a month, it sort of, you know, I was weaned off this, and I occasionally cross it. She goes, like that at me. I thought, "Oh, sorry." Right. It's become a little leitmotif occasionally, you know. But that's an external focus, all right, when there's an assumption then of the internal. Of course, our job is to read external and then try to move to internal. Okay, not to jump to one or the other, or not to keep to one. Okay, and the other one, of course, is the sort of dimension of affect, which I'll come to, the emotional states and how they may govern. And Seth was talking a bit about that with the amygdala processing and so on. And actually, the more cognitive states, which tend to be more frontal lobe phenomena and so on, these sort of higher functions. And these are different components within mentalizing. So, what do you get here? Well, you can plot out where these sort of mentalizing poles are or are not for patients and for yourself for that matter, and at what times, and of course they shift. And what we defined is that in general, though, for borderline personality disorder, they're much more implicit, they're much more impression driven, all right? And this goes along with actually this self-affect state, propositional state, which is much more driven by the emotional experience. So when you feel something, it is, right? It's not just a feeling, it becomes something, right? So if you feel something, it's reality, right? So if I feel you stole that, you did steal it. You see what I mean? I'm not going to be able to question it all that well because it's a very strong feeling. So it's an affect state proposition, all right? If I say, "Well, I feel that Jim stole that," or something, this is a much more cognitive state. It's true, but I also know that Jim might not have done so. Do you see what I mean? This is a more cognitively driven state of mind, right? Now, neither is better or worse. The problem is if you get fixed in one, okay? This is the problem. So, but you can also be very externally focused, and you make big assumptions from the external focus. So as soon as you start being at one end of these, either at either end, if you're too internally focused, you're in real trouble. If you're self-focused and internally focused, of course you start generally, "Well, I'm such a terrible thing, it's all really all awful." You drive everybody else mad, but you actually spend your time going around in your own mind. So this interferes with the interpersonal interactional processes, all right? Anyway, so what do you do then? In therapy, the point is here to try to increase flexibility in these systems. All right? So rather than be so self-orientated, you get someone to push to be a bit other if they're very trapped in self. If they're very other-orientated, try to push them back to self. So you try to move them around. All right? And since I had a very long plane journey not so long ago, you can now see that I spent 2 hours bored at the back of the plane trying to work out how to move these around. It's fantastic. It took me 2 hours, by the way, but it did at least. All right? So what you're trying to do is get the person to shift, okay? To shift around. And that's really what you're trying to do in therapy with the mentalizing process, okay? It's the flexibility. It's the uncertainty, the doubt, the move from the external assumption to try to check it out with the internal, all right? The move from the trapped in the internal to consider the external and so on. Okay, so you move it, so you have doubts about your belief systems, you check them out with others and so on, all right? Now, you can move them back and forth, but you follow, I hope you get the idea. This is to do with the interactional process. Now, we know that the thing that interferes with this mentalizing is primarily emotional states, all right? It can be other things. It can be bodily symptoms. That can, you know, yesterday I had to disappear from my bodily symptom, my little bladder. Suddenly I couldn't think anymore. I thought, I think I'd better go and deal with this little function that we all have. You know, and things like all sorts of things can interfere. But for borderline personality disorder, it's primarily emotional states within the interpersonal situation. That is actually where the problem lies. And actually it switches people across to these more panic-driven, these more immediate processes, rather than control processes that Seth was talking about. So, and people with borderline personality disorder tend to switch earlier. They're much more reactive. They're much more sensitive. And we know that for, both temperamentally and developmentally they become so. So that's what interferes with it. So clinically in therapy, it's terribly important, of course, to manage arousal states, to manage emotional states so they're held within a certain range. They're not too low, because that's going to be a problem, to be honest, or not too high, which will disrupt the whole process. So that's your job. So you've got two jobs so far, if I can mention it, in MBT. One is to start focusing on the mentalizing process of self and other, moving them around explicitly or implicitly, trying to get hold of the implicit assumptions and make them more explicit. All right, that's one maneuver, all right, that you're going to do. You're certainly going to try to get hold of the affect state propositions, the thing that I feel this, therefore it is it really? Get the more cognitive component in to question it, to represent it, and so on. All right, so you've got quite a few maneuvers already, and now you're going to try to keep the emotional states at least within a reasonable range, all right, within your interpersonal interactional process. And that's represented here because it's these processes that disrupt mentalizing. Okay? And that's where we suggest the problem lies. Once mentalizing is disrupted, affect storms arise, and you start engaging in actually self-soothing or self-righting behaviors, as it were, such as self-harm, for example, and so on, that fall out of this. So they become the end point. But the thing that stimulates this so much that we think they're highly sensitive to is actually that patients are highly sensitive to with borderline personality disorder is actually being misunderstood. A sense that someone else does not understand your internal state and is not empathic with that internal state is very aversive for these people. And it is for all of us, actually, particularly if we want the other person to understand. If we've no interest, it doesn't really matter. But assuming we do, then it becomes very aversive. So being misunderstood is incredibly important in this system. Okay? So when anything happens in your therapy, in MBT, it actually, for example, somebody suddenly gets an emotional storm within the session or something like that, suddenly gets angry or appears very hurt, it's likely that you as the therapist have misunderstood their internal state. That's where we would take it initially. That's the first component that you have to try to get hold of. Okay. So that's my little sort of summary of mentalizing. But try and just remember the poles of mentalizing that we've defined, because it's moving the person around that sort of system that's very important for practicing MBT. So where do we think these problems arise? Well, we think they arise, and this has already been shown, so I'm not going to show it, but we think the major problem was in the relational realm. There is certainly the affect dysregulation, impulsivity, and problems with aggression. These are mostly described. Now, our theoretical base and our scientific base and study base is primarily within the attachment relationship and with child developmental systems. Now, just to reiterate what I often say and want to emphasize, this is not to do with having a bad mum. This is to do with an interactional process between temperamental factors, environmental circumstances, and then the infant mother, let's say, or caregiver relationship, the interactional process is a problem, which makes a sensitivity, we suspect, which may be added to by trauma later, but not necessarily so. But we see it as arising within the interactional process between the environment, the temperamental factors, and the child-mother relationship, okay, for whichever way. Okay, and what we suggest is fairly straightforward, that in fact you develop a sense of who you are and begin to develop representational levels about yourself, your internal states and your mental states through the mind of another, and in this case, of course, let's say it's the mum. The mum represents your internal state or your current state, and that allows you to gradually develop and build up a sense of yourself. So you develop a psychological self. You develop a sense of actually this experience in this context is anger or hurt or whatever feeling it is. You don't know what feelings are. And actually, I find it remarkable when people, books, have lists of feelings. I don't think I have those 84 feelings, you know. Maybe there was some problem with mine. I remember there's hundreds of you seen this lists. I think, oh, my goodness, I have about four, you know, rage, spite, bitterness, you know, and things. And there's a little pocket of love occasionally pops through or something. But you know, you get these incredible lists. But the point here is that, of course, developing these nuances takes time and through representation and representational levels of actually what your experiences are in different contexts. And we think that it occurs through this process with the caregiver. But there's two components we think are incredibly important, and we've translated through to the therapeutic interaction, particularly in borderline personality disorder. And I'm just going to mention them because they're very distinct clinically. And one is contingency. One is, if you like, the reciprocity between my experience and your reaction to my experience, right? And the accuracy of how you represent my experience that builds up with my previous experience of the same thing, if you see what I mean. Then this is the sort of contingency. How much is that me, in other words, that I therefore see out there? And if it could be non-contingent. So a non-contingent response would be something like, if I cry, or something, that somebody doesn't actually go, oh, you know, dear, or something like that, and they go, you know, or something. This is a non-contingent system that's set up, and you may feel hurt, but the fact they don't respond in a way that you might. And the second component of it is the marking, that if you represent someone's mental states or someone's underlying experience back to them or how you're understanding it, you have to show in some way that you're representing their mental state, your understanding of their mental state, and not yours. Okay? So it's not you. So let's say the child feels anxious, right? And you represent their sort of anxiety. So you say, oh, dear, oh, yes, I know. You do something a little bit complicated, but you show this is the representation of them that's coming from your representation in your mind. Okay, that would be marking it. But if they get anxious and you say, oh, God, I don't know what to do, then it's not clear who's anxious here. Are you anxious or are you representing their anxiety and so on? It gets muddled up. This is not marking. Okay. So what we're suggesting is that this process simply develops through, and Lois showed this yesterday, develops through to form representations for you of self-states. This is a developmental process. There's quite a lot of evidence for this. I'm not just making it up. Right? The question is whether or not the problems in this system leads through to borderline personality disorder or indeed other disorders. That's really where the questions arise. And there is some increasing evidence that this does appear to be the case, that actually some vulnerabilities at this point will lead through over to 18 or 22 now to serious problems, in fact. But let's just have a look so you're clear about this contingency thing. This is actually a mum and baby. And this is accurate and marked mirroring. So could you turn the video off for this, please? And for the next one. I don't want this on video. Thank you very much. Don't tape it. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention. No, he's done it. He's very good. He's very responsive. He's concentrating. He's still awake. He's fantastic. He's young, of course. You see. But this is to do with accuracy and to do with the marking. So, and this is a still face test. So if you watch the child, they're interacting. I'll just go back. But they're interacting. They're interacting, and then the mum will go still. This is a standardized still face test. And you watch the baby. That's all. Okay. And then watch the response. They then start interacting again afterwards. Okay, so just see if I can get this going. The sound's very low because it's not coming through, but don't worry. Okay, so they're interacting. And she's actually representing her sense of the infant's sort of state of mind. Not of this, no. Okay, now the still face. Now watch this child. The child becomes somewhat distressed, in fact, and you can categorize that and you can actually measure it. And they're interacting again. Now what we're suggesting here, you can see how quickly the child recovers, right, from this. And we suggest that what's going on here, that in the accuracy and the contingency and the marking, the child has an experience of existing, if you like, of self. Here I am and I'm interacting and so on. When the mother stops interacting, child sort of begins to lose a sense of self. If we go back to the definition you had of personality disorder, but obviously this is not personality disorder, and the loses that and starts to one sort of where am I type sense in some way. And then when they start interacting, the child says, oh, there I am again, because the mother's interacting again. Okay, and this is the process that you build up. If we have a look at one very briefly, which is a sort of, and don't take this, which is a low, less accurate and a less marked mirroring. They're interacting, and they've been interacting for a bit in these tests. And the mum goes still now, the light's gone on, so they have to still face and watch this child. Child spends a lot of time now self-focused, in fact, pulling at himself and looking at himself, interacting again. Okay, a little more difficult. The child doesn't recover. As such, it's not very clear at the beginning if you measure it that the marking is very clear about her. And the mum's got a moderate depression, all right? So she's unable to focus so well on the other and so on, in this case the child and so on. So you get an interference in the process. And this is what we mean by the accuracy and the markedness. Now, what's the significance of this? Well, it's significant clinically. We've translated it through to the clinical system, particularly when you're interacting with a person with borderline personality disorder, and where there's an instability in the sense of self, which is particularly disrupted by emotional states. So, of course, if you stop interacting, and those of you who don't believe me just need to, if you're seeing someone with a severe borderline personality disorder, just stop interacting for a few minutes in a session, all right, and see what happens, all right? It's not very nice, because it's very, very painful to the person who's sitting looking at you, because actually they begin to actually become unstable, all right? So it's quite easily done. So beware of it. So this question of contingency and markedness is very key to practicing MBT. So I am representing your mental state, or I am actually just trying to work out your mental state. I don't know what it is. I can't represent it. So everything has to be carefully marked, and as best you can, of course, it has to be reasonably accurate. And no still faces, please. I'd rather you went, ooh, or something, than just went, you know, just a bit of expressiveness goes a long way, okay? And with that authenticity, I mean, I don't mean you make it up, but it has to be there, because it's this process that can cause such considerable trouble. The reason it causes trouble is that we think that these processes, when they're disrupted for whatever reasons, lead to a sensitivity in the attachment system. So you've got a bit of a hair trigger attachment system, okay, that develops over time. And what we think is that let's take a more severe problem of exposure to actual maltreatment. When you're maltreated or when you're in pain in some way, it activates the attachment system. That is what the attachment system's for. It's a proximity-seeking system, but it's also triggered by fear. That's what happens. A child will actually move off and be safe and turn around and look at mum and wave. Mum goes, ooh, yeah, fine, and carry on. And then somebody comes and goes, ooh, and back they go. Okay, and mum says, oh, no, it's all right. No, it's all right. Oh, hello, child. And off you go again, all right? It's triggered by this system. Well, of course, if you're fearful, what happens, that activates the attachment system, all right? So you're, and in doing so, you actually get problematic interactions, particularly if your attachment system is moving towards the adverse experience in some way, all right? So you actually go round in a cycle where it may be that you're experiencing maltreatment, that stimulates fear, that stimulates the attachment system, and the very person who should give you safety in some way actually triggers more fear. So it becomes hypersensitive, is our suggestion. And this may be why that actually getting a hypersensitivity of the attachment system in borderline personality disorder. They're very sensitive, they react quickly, they experience things in a much more extensively than other people, and so on, and they can't easily return to baseline once this is system set up. So it's within the interpersonal domain, and it's actually on a hair trigger type thing. So it leads to the things that are described in the literature, like clinging, desperation, the sense of need, and the instability then, and the intensity of the interpersonal relationships, particularly the intimate relationships, right, which is going on. Okay. So it's the hyperactivation. Now, this, of course, gets translated into the psychiatric system, into the therapy system. So you're getting an activation of the attachment system. An emotional challenging position leads to distress. They may then activate. They may then contact the system, contact the therapist, send emails. All sorts of things will occur. And actually, that is done as a proximity-seeking device, and in the end you get emotionally challenging experiences between the mental health workers, the therapist, and the individual, the patient with borderline personality disorder. And this has to be taken into account in any treatment system, right? And it's not taken into account adequately, in my view. Since we're talking mostly about MBT and DBT, I do think they take this seriously. They package round, as we've heard, actually supervision or consults or support for therapists and so on in various ways. They tend to define crisis management, how to deal with things and so on. These are all to actually, I think, to contain this system, which is a very sensitive system, okay, which is developed. Okay, so that's what we think is going on. But just finally to say that when you activate the attachment system, we now know that you inhibit a mentalizing process. So the actual... Now, we know this, for example. You know this in your own life. When you activate the attachment system, well, what does that? What does that? You fall in love. Okay. I told you I didn't have that sort of thing, but I have a bit. You know. You fall in love. What happens? Your mate says, you know, you're in your 20s, and you say, you know, oh, she's fantastic. And they know this person you've just fallen in love with, and they say, are you sure? You know, and you say, oh, don't you stop. Oh, God, you spoil everything. Forget, you cannot think about the inappropriateness of this relationship you're just embarking on, all right? You just don't do it. Fortunately, actually, a lot of the time. But nevertheless, it inhibits your capacity to think about this. Okay. Sorry, I thought I had an hour. I'm miles behind. All right, I've got 15 minutes more at least, otherwise I'm...
We'll do 15 minutes more. We can do that.
Okay. I've got to stand up for myself here. Okay, but it's the inhibition of mentalizing that is very important here, because in therapy, which I'm now going on for because I'm going to do it, is actually you actually want to maintain mentalizing when it would otherwise be switched off. Okay, so I'm going to jump just to get it. Now, the first thing, therefore, that I've said here, this is a therapist is going to actually make sure that they maintain their own mentalizing. And this is done through the team approach, support of the therapist, supervision, and so on, but they need to do it in the session. So we define the therapist stance, which is called the not-knowing stance, And in the not knowing stance, it must be very clear that you do not have a position of knowing underlying mental states. Okay? You have a position of trying to work out underlying mental states, and you have a position of trying to know your own mental states. That's your job. Okay? So if a patient says you're thinking something, or say, well, you don't like me very much, do you, or something, your job would be to work out, well, actually, do I or don't I? You know, they say I don't, that's how they see me. Okay? Do I or don't I here? Because that's a very good, important point. It may be that I don't at the moment, or something like that. Do you see what I mean? So you actually are uncertain about mental states. So if a patient says that to you, you simply say, well, that's actually quite a good question, actually, whether I do or not at the moment. And actually, when now you ask it, I mean, I'm making this up, you know, you might say, well, now you ask it at the moment, actually, I don't think I do like, you keep putting me on the spot, you keep doing this at me, you know, or something that like that might be very important, right? And then you say, I'm not sure what that's about, or something of that sort. But not knowing, actually, is distinctly important in our position. This doesn't mean to say you know nothing about borderline personality disorder. It does not mean you sit there and say, I don't know. I don't know. How would I know? You know, who am I to know? This is not. That's not MBT. But you do say, when the patient says, well, what should I do about it? You say, well, actually, I don't know. Let's try and work that out. That's what we're here to do, isn't it? You know. Now, if you do know what they should do about it, I don't mean one of the skills or anything else like that, I'm not talking about that, but they say, well, I don't know what to do about it because of this or this, and the answer's absolutely obvious, then in MBT you say, well, it just seems to me so obvious that I'd do this. You know, whatever the thing is, it's barn door obvious. I said, but what I can't understand, how come you don't see that? Am I missing something, maybe? Because I think that looks obvious. Do you see what I mean? And then you start trying to work out, how come you don't see that? Because it seems so obvious to me, but maybe I'm missing something here, not you. You know, it's more complex than I thought, or something of that sort. But this is the not knowing stance. So you will make errors. You make errors about understanding someone else's mental states. It's easily done. You will make errors. They can be corrected, of course. That's the point. So you will own up to misunderstandings or not understanding. So essential in the stance is you're keeping it current. You're keeping it interpersonal. This is you and me, and we need to focus on that. And as Lois pointed out yesterday, we tend to get what is your state of mind at the moment, currently, about the subject you're talking or about the relationship you're talking about. You move that to the interpersonal, and that will then move out to outside as well, to consider the interpersonal relationships outside. So you're commonly exploring things in the relational realm. You keep arousal within a certain level, not over-aroused, not under-aroused, because the problem is the emotional states that they can't manage. So you don't want everything closed down, not within the interpersonal situation. You want things actually present in the current. So we give our therapists some hints. I mentioned to you moving about the self and other, explicitly and implicitly, looking at external focus, internal focus, managing arousal, and of course you're trying to get them to shift the focus to some extent. Okay. And some of this, these are contrary moves, so if the patient is very knowing, you might become unknowing. You say, actually, I'm very impressed how certain you are about that, actually. How do you come you're so sure? Because it doesn't seem so certain to me. Do you see what I mean? You'd express some doubt into the system. But if they're very, very doubtful, you might actually say something that actually increases the level of certainty, because these are problems once they become extreme. So you're always trying to balance across these different areas. So interventions are actually looking for breaks in mentalizing where they are. There's subtle hints for breaks in mentalizing. Many of them are very obvious, okay? You know, they're very obvious indeed. They're absolutes. You know, he betrayed me. Never, I'm never going to see him again, you know. And you say, well, hang on a moment. I thought you loved him last week. Don't talk to me about that. He's finished, you know, or whatever. It's very extreme, these shifts in mentalizing, right? You know, but if they happen to say, you know, it's really difficult because actually I feel I have this impression of my boyfriend. You know, I really felt in love with him, and now he seems like that. I just don't know what's going on. Then you think, oh, there's some consideration here. There's some reflection. There's some uncertainty. Then it maybe mentalizing is occurring. Right? So you identify breaks. Look for subtle things, though. They're things like, well, he's just an idiot. Very few people are an idiot, and very people are just an idiot. They're usually a little bit more complex. You see what I mean? These are subtle hints of non-mentalizing, which we all use, by the way. But look out for the just word and things like that. Only this. Is it really? Always that. You know, these are hints that maybe it's kind of a bit more complicated than that. Okay? So you're going to pick on those things to some extent. So you're going to take the mentalizing stance, and you're going to be inquisitive, we're curious, we're uncertain, we actually have a measured enthusiasm for mental states, not just behaviors and so on, in that sort of sense. We look to that, and we try to build up a narrative flow as well as intervening, getting it unpacked, getting it expanded, getting it into a more complex, richer process, really, rather than just, and then I went down to the bridge and I thought, well, I'm going to jump off, so I've had enough, and then somebody stopped me, and so, you know, that's the little bit of narrative. That needs all unpacking, all right, which you would do within the mentalizing stance, all right? You want to try and terminate inaccurate, these just words, these only, pick them up so that non-mentalizing doesn't get rooted too quickly, and reinforce positive mentalizing. Judicious praise is described in our manual, and so on. Okay. So we then set out some, and I'm going to finish shortly, so we'll have time for some discussion and questions. We set out some basic interventions within this frame I've just given you. So the frame is, look for mentalizing and non-mentalizing, look for self and other, representation of self, plus my representation of my patient, look for the patient's representation of me, plus the patient's representation of themselves, and move around that, okay? Move around the explicit and implicit components, mostly making what seems like assumptions much more explicit, all right? Okay, there could be an idealized, oh, Professor Bateman, I'm so glad I've got to see you. You know, I've been waiting for the whole, you know, sort of thing, you know, that goes on sometimes. These are implicit assumptions of idealization. You want to get them explicit, you see, and start moving around that. Look for the affect state propositions. I feel it, therefore it is. Okay, and try to get some of the more cognitive ones. If somebody's highly cognitive, you want a little bit more affect state in it, okay, because we operate from both. Right? These are very important maneuvers, so that's the frame. Then have a look at just these. We start with, and we recommend you always start with empathic alongside the patient, the patient's current experience, that is, not just being nice about the fact that they're in trouble or something. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm empathic about your current experience now about how things are. And we clarify, and you might challenge. Challenge has a particular definition, which is simply related to when non-mentalizing has continued and not actually been put in a mentalizing mode, you might need to really give it a whack, okay? And the challenge is something that's outside the normal therapy frame, okay? And it has to trip the patient, it has to be unexpected. So it's a little bit like, it's a little bit like lobbing a grenade when it's not expected, but not one that blows up too much. Just go bang, and they go, oh, God, they stop, okay? And they said, now I've got your attention. You're light on it when you do that, all right? And then you move to mentalize the relationship, which was mentalizing it within the interpersonal process between you and the patient. And those are basically the steps that we train people in different contexts, okay? The important thing here in mentalizing the relationship is that you do try to enrich the experience or understanding in terms of alternative perspectives, okay? So a typical example might be a patient of mine, and then I will finish, who felt that I forgot about him, which indeed I did, so I could validate this. This was because I had to change the time of his session, and I forgot to rearrange the time of the following session when he left, and I then remembered, and I went back, and I said to him, so, Stephen, please come back. I said, I realize I forgot to rearrange next week's session because I'm not here on Tuesday. And he turned to me and he said, nearly forgot, did we? I thought. So I said, yes, I did. I said, come on back. So I came back, changed it. Next session, he says, you know, you don't remember much about me. You know, there was sort of thing. I could validate this, explore what had happened in our relationship, how I forgot it, my contribution to this. But actually, the difference here was the alternative perspective became actually he rather liked the idea that he then felt that he had a little bit of hold over me because he could make me feel guilty. Do you see what I mean? It moves to a different perspective about the interpersonal interactional process, right? It's a little bit deeper. It's an alternative perspective. So then we could work on that. What's going on here? And he likes this idea, you know, and so on. So this is mentalizing the relationship, okay? There are dangers in it, but I won't say. And within that, we utilize the experience of the therapist, which is placed, the mind of the therapist has to be reasonably open and authentic. So there is open self-disclosure about the mental states of the therapist in relation to the patient's mental states. Okay, and this is how we use what is normally termed in the literature of counter-transference. So I'm going to finish there, but that gives you an idea, I hope, of the focus on mentalizing. The theory that we have about how mentalizing develops, how it can be disrupted, and how the therapist will spend their time trying to work on helping the person maintain mentalizing when it would otherwise been lost, particularly in emotional states within the interpersonal situation. So the interpersonal relationship becomes the focus for the therapy itself. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Bateman. We have time for questions. I don't know if questions have been coming into our volunteers, but if you have, please pass them on, and I'd be happy to share those with Dr. Bateman on this introduction to mentalization. There will be numerous opportunities throughout the day to pose questions to Dr. Bateman as well as to Dr. Fazzetti, as they will be both doing clinical demonstrations, and they will also be present when we do panels toward the end of the day. But if there's any first questions, I would take them. May they come in, please? Thank you. We have, how would you work with individuals with borderline personality disorder with physical cognitive disabilities such as mental retardation, autism, and fetal alcohol syndrome? If you would comment on that.
If I find the person who's asked that question, I mean, that's a really, really complicated question. It obviously covers a wide range of areas. There is a very small correlation, by the way, between mentalizing abilities and IQ, but it's quite small. It's about 0.2. So, clearly, you're not expecting high levels of mentalizing capacity with very low levels of IQ, but the correlation is, in terms of mentalizing, is not very high, in fact. To do with autism and so on, there are obviously, I'm not sure what the aim of the question is in terms of where you'd really like me to approach it, but autism clearly has mentalizing problems, particularly of monitoring mental states of others, for example, as well as self, in fact, and there are mentalizing difficulties. That's not the same as mentalizing or MBT, for example, being useful in that condition particularly, although there are people trying to do some work with specifically training mentalizing understandings and abilities in that condition. But I'm not sure. It's a very complex area because the cause of the mentalizing problem is very, very different in autism, say, from borderline personality disorder, for example. So as an intervention, it may or may not be have some use, but it's probably limited, in fact.
How transparent are you with your patients in terms of mentalization theory? Do you talk about use language from mentalization theory in session?
We might. We don't talk about it much in session, but there is an introductory program to MBT so that patients are aware what the ideas are behind it, what the expectation is from therapy, what mentalizing is, for example, and so on. And the importance, really, of attending to mental states is actually, we don't use loads and loads of jargon, but we do, in fact, now have an introductory group process that patients have for a number of weeks, which covers all sorts sorts of aspects of borderline personality disorder, attachment, mentalizing, and other aspects, and then what they can expect from treatment. So they're well aware of what treatment's about, yes.
Could you say what you mean by developmental competence? Apparently that was a phrase that got used. Was there a phrase, developmental competence?
I'm not sure.
We're going to let that one go.
Someone asked me. I'm not sure what context I used.
Okay. How would MBT work for a patient with obsessive thought patterns?
Yeah. Obsessive thought patterns actually are a very interesting phenomenon, but from a mentalizing perspective, they are, as it were, non-mentalizing because they actually don't move anywhere. They tend to be circular or non-constructive. They tend to be a bit painful and a little bit ego-dystonic, for example. But they're very self-preoccupied, so you really have to start trying to shift the person away from their internal state to actually other states and consideration of other as well at the same time. So they are a big problem, actually, obsessional thought patterns.
There were some terms. There was a question if you could say a bit more about some of these terms. The first is psychic equivalence.
Yeah, I skipped over that because you didn't give me much time.
So now's your chance.
So it's your fault. Psychic equivalence is, I don't worry too much about these terms. I did actually say what it was in essence, but didn't label it, that in psychic equivalence, the experience that you have is absolute and current and now. So, and it's reality. So if I feel bad, there's not an as-if quality to it. It's just that I am bad. That is it. Okay, so that's your state. It's basically an affect state propositional element. If I feel I'm wonderful, I am wonderful. That's it. You can't tell me I'm not. Do you see what I mean? So you can't argue people out of psychic equivalence. We had it yesterday in one of the role plays. The patient said something like, but I want it. And I want it, therefore I must have it. Do you see, it has this quality to it, which is rather absolute. And you can't easily say, well, you don't really need it. What do you mean I didn't need it? I feel I have to have it. All right, so they have to have it. All right, and the experience is very absolute.
Another term was pretend mode. Pretend mode?
I didn't mention these terms.
Maybe they were on the slide. I'm not sure.
They were, yeah.
Teleological stance was another that I think showed up.
Teleological stance is to do with judging things by their physical outcomes. So we had that again yesterday. There was a psychic equivalent component and a teleological component where the patient said, I will know that you care about me if you see me for longer. All right? So care becomes confused with the amount of time. Is it 15 minutes you see me for or 25 minutes? Because 25 minutes, you care. So do you see what I mean? It's that outcome in the physical real world that determines actually what your understanding and motive is and so on. Pretend mode is a bit more complex, but pretend mode, somebody mentioned the obsessional components. That's very often in pretend mode where people will talk about intellectualized, rather rationalized states of mind that really don't evoke states of mind in other people. They just shut other people's minds off, and they're not communicating in the normal way. But they're developmental concepts as well as psychologically important.
We have a couple of questions asking you to compare MBT and TFP. What are some basic similarities, differences between, and TFP is transference focused psychotherapy that is based in Kernberg's object relations theory. That's the current version that's researched. Could you comment on that, MBT and TFP?
I mean, there are a number of sort of structural differences. We have group plus individual therapy. That's our format, whereas TFP has twice weekly individual therapy, I think. They have a different conceptual base, certainly, and that does, I think, alter clinically what they do. They also, although they may argue with me that they don't, but I mean, just within the manual, they're much more focused on the unconscious process of the patient and the meaning of that and the interpretation in relation to insight to those unconscious processes, whereas we're not that bothered about those unconscious processes and certainly not about interpretation. So the mentalizing the relationship is not to do with interpretive components, and originally we did write about interpretive mentalizing, but that muddled everyone, including us, who just removed it from the system because it got muddled with actually giving interpretations and things, and that's not what we do in MBT. So I think there probably are, I think there are distinct differences.
There's a question about, do you feel that family members could be trained in mentalization techniques so that they can repair relationships? If so, how can that be accomplished?
Well, I think the best person to answer that is Valerie Paul from Tara, because she does train people in mentalizing techniques and relatives, parents, and partners and people. And my understanding is that, yes, A, they understand it very quickly and easily, they relate to it, and they're able to implement some of the techniques and ideas in how they then respond to emotional states of their loved one or anyone else and so on, and find it very helpful. That's rapport. We do actually have a little program for relatives and people ourselves. And you know.
And I'll mention that some of Valerie Poore's literature is out, and her book is available with the bookseller that also reviews these issues. One more term, and then we'll take a question or two from the balcony if there are up there. Another term is mental states. What are examples of mental states? Is that, that's a big question. I don't know. Can you say something about, should we go
look,
on?
Can I, okay. Look, mental states are layered. Okay, you know, how you represent yourself in your mind would be a mental state, okay? So if I ask you to describe yourself, all right, you will utilize your self-image, you will access certain aspects of your views about yourself, your perspectives on yourself and so on. Now, so that's one thing. There's a cognitive component. The emotional components are equally important, all right? How you feel about yourself, what is that your underlying feeling state and so on. And you may be more or less aware of some of that, and it may shift in and out. But let's just take what I mean when you're sitting with a patient, trying to understand what their mental state is. What actually is their sense of who they are and what they're trying to do at the moment? Are they trying to explain something to me? Are they trying to actually convince me of something? Or they think I'm doubtful? You know, what's their sense of me? How are they representing me? All these are different layers of those mental processes. Okay, but very often we go for one that's just slightly beneath the surface. I'll give you an example from yesterday, since it works in the role play, was that the patient had been fired by their therapist, all right, because they were too suicidal and so on. Okay? They were sensing another therapist. Now, it's highly likely that part of their mental process is when they're sitting with their new therapist will be actually wondering if this other therapist is going to fire them. Why wouldn't you think that? You know, you've been fired by two already. So why wouldn't this? Do you see what I mean? And that might be part of that layered mental state. They're sitting there thinking, is he going to fire me? And we would try to identify those in MBT. So you try to identify them all as you go through.
We have several questions that refer to the way that MBT is delivered, whether it can be done in a group, what kind of schedule. Can it be done in inpatient, outpatient, intensive outpatient? Can you say a little bit about what are some of the different ways and how often people meet for MBT?
Well, the first way we did it was try to adapt it in a partial hospital setting, so it can definitely be done in that. That's less common now, partly because of expense, and it may be unnecessary. We also do it as an intensive outpatient, and that's individual plus group, the group for an hour and a half, and the individual session for an hour, and those therapists work conjointly, as it were, i.e. they know what's going on in each component of the treatment. There are places that are trying to use MBT as the underlying milieu within an inpatient setting. So, in other words, the construct, the conceptual component that the nursing staff, for example, rely on is the mentalizing process. So if anything happens, it's taken from a mentalizing perspective, all right? And the whole team work on that. So they're implementing in that sort of way in inpatient units and so on. So, yeah, it's adaptable to different contexts, I think.
Thank you. I want to take one last question that came off of my talk. I also want to give an opportunity to have an announcement before we break. There are more questions we did not get to that we will get to pose to Dr. Bateman and the other experts, including the MBT experts, that we will be able to incorporate later today. There was one question that came in. I think there was a concern about the way I presented things, about if there's limited access to specialty treatments and training, how are so many clinicians practicing and treating ethically and effectively? And I think I may have painted a very grim picture. And the message is that clinicians are doing the best they can. And the concerning thing for me is when clinicians are treating individuals with borderline personality disorder without accounting for the special needs and special methods addressing the issues that make them distinct. I would commend any of the treaters here or any out in the community that are doing their very best to apply the best treatment they can. My commentary was that it's often difficult to provide the evidence-based, the empirically supported treatments in the way that they're studied, such as a DBT consultation team, a regular MBT supervision. However, doing the best you can is what would be recommended. And I know I've heard Marsha Linehan refer to the fact that it is possible for certain clinicians, at least, to read her book and actually do the therapy from that. It's not the recommended training, but there's lots of ways to get the training. Something that Dr. Bateman spoke about a bit yesterday was that so many of his resources on his treatment are freely available. So there are opportunities to do your best at implementing, and there are lots of challenges in terms of providing a complete practice, and that's what I was really trying to draw attention to, if that helps respond to that. I want to thank Dr. Bateman for his talk and questions and answers.